Sheila Gilbert with us today. A mutual friend of ours insisted we needed to meet, and after I met her, I understood why, and it's been a wonderful friendship ever since. And we met at a cafe on Emek Rephaim, and as soon as we finished getting to know each other over that cup of coffee, I ran home and I Googled her name and looked up to see what books she had written, and the list is prolific. And to my shock and surprise, and as Chuck mentioned, there was his cousin's book that she had authored, and so we knew we were family from then on. But it's just been a joy to see how God has used her in this country, the hearts and homes and doors he's opened of very influential people in this land, and not just because of her gifts, but because of her amazing love for the Lord and what he's done in her life. And I'll let her come and share that today. Thank you, Lila, for coming.
Well, I want to say that these two Christians are among the most authentic Christians I've ever known. And I am so honored to be your friend. Happy. There's a reason some of us sit behind computers and write and don't speak publicly. Because it's easier. But I thank you for listening anyway. And I'll try to share with you some of the things that have happened in my life that led me to this place, most of which I didn't understand as I walked through. I looked back over this last night when I was trying to figure out what to say, and I realized how long I've been alive. And now this could go on forever, but also how much waiting on the Lord was involved. And I decided to read the scripture that I underlined when I was 18. I grew up in a Christian home, and I'll explain that in a few minutes. But at around 16, 17, 18, I started actually looking in the Bible for guidance and help. And in Isaiah chapter 30, verses 18 through 21, I read, "Therefore will the Lord wait, that he may be gracious to you. And therefore he will be exalted, that he may have mercy on you. For the Lord is a God of justice. Blessed are all those who wait for him. For the people shall dwell in Zion at Jerusalem. You shall weep no more. He will be very gracious to you at the sound of your cry. When he hears it, he will answer you. And though the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet your teachers will not be moved into a corner anymore. But your eyes shall see your teachers, and your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, 'This is the way. Walk in it.' Whenever you turn to the right and whenever you turn to the left." And this is kind of a mysterious passage in a lot of ways. And I look back over the years and I realize that so much of this has become more clear and some of it isn't clear at all. I will start because in one of the places where I think Liz and I found common ground was that we both grew up in very conservative Christian families. My family was not entirely a loving family. It was my parents identified themselves very proudly as fundamentalist Christians. And for them, that meant that sound doctrine and justice were very, very important. There was not as much emphasis on love and on compassion as there is in other homes and churches. This was the way it was. And it was a lot of arguments about church teachings. Those were the days when Pentecostalism was coming up through many churches, and my parents strongly disapproved of it, strongly disapproved of most notably the gift of tongues, but also the belief that the apostolic gifts were still active in the world. And so they were met when these people came along in our churches, and we went from church to church because they had a lot of fights with pastors and took a lot of sermons apart in the car on the way home. And when these people came along, they were judged, and they were judged either as emotionally unstable or even worse, perhaps demonically influenced. So the family life that had to do with Jesus was not a particularly focused on loving him or loving others. It was more focused on getting it right. And I'm afraid that I stand before you saying I never got it right. never got it right. Nobody does. It's as someone else was saying, we're sinners. And it's by his mercy, not by deeds of righteousness, that we do. But another factor in my life was that I was very diseased. I had a skin disease, eczema, atopic dermatitis, whatever the term is that is used. It was almost complete coverage of my body by the time I was 12 years old. And I was disfigured by it. I was extremely uncomfortable. I was actually an outcast in many ways. And the older I got, the more obvious it was that I was just pushed aside by this. And it was unsightly. It itched constantly, and it peeled and flaked and covered my real skin. You couldn't really see my skin. This went on for, it was always there, but from around puberty until I was about 20, it was almost overpowering. It ran my life. So I'm in a home that doesn't believe in healing, and I'm in a home where you might pray that God would guide the hand of the surgeon, but you would never pray for a miracle. And we didn't, and maybe on the mission field, maybe, but certainly not in our local church. That was just not the way it worked. So you can imagine my surprise when I was walking home from school one day in college. I went to college at 16. I was quite young. And I went to a Christian college because that's the only place that my parents thought I could go or should go. And at some point, actually it was at a Billy Graham crusade, I somehow got to the point where I gave this disease to God and said, "Thy will be done. You gave it to me for a purpose, to mold me." I came to realize that it wasn't an accident, and I could no longer be bitter and angry at my disfigurement. And my people got up and moved away from me on the bus. I mean, it was very, very difficult. I was walking down the street I was about 20, and I heard in my mind the words, "I want to heal your skin." And I said, "Leave me alone." And I heard it again, and I said the same thing. And it happened, I think, three times. I walked in the house and told my mother, who said, "Well, don't get your hopes up," which she often said. I went to my room and I prayed, and I knew that they believed that some of these things were diabolical, these kinds of voices and ideas. So I prayed that if it was of the devil, it would go away. And then I said in my humble way, "Lord, if that's you, then go ahead and try." That's as far as I could get with it. We only knew to go to doctors. We didn't know any other way of healing. No one laid hands on anyone or anything like that. And we went to one doctor and another doctor. And the third appointment with a dermatologist that was new in town, I noticed that there were patches of skin showing under all this crust. And it was getting better. And it was like when you take the car in to the mechanic and it doesn't make the weird sound. And I was feeling uneasy because I thought, well, she's not going to know how bad this is if it starts getting better. And I went in and I told her, "You know, this is a little better than usual." She said, "Well, it's bad enough." And she gave me these little containers of some sort of cream. Now, I must say, I forgot to mention that at 14, I was hospitalized with this condition, and I almost died. I was in the hospital 6 weeks. It ended up being a staph infection that had entered my bloodstream through the open sores. And a little Jewish doctor, actually, from Europe, stayed up all night one night to try to understand what was happening to me, and he took me off the intense doses of cortisone they were giving me to try to stop this and put me on antibiotics to save my life. But the point of that is, not only did God save my life, but cortisone didn't heal it. But when this doctor gave me these little tubes, it was corticosteroid ointments. It wasn't even internal. I was well in 48 hours, and it never came back. And I was afraid. I had nightmares that it was back. I'd get up and look in the bathroom mirror at 3 in the morning because it was so unbelievable. It was a miracle visually. I went from really unsightly to attractive in 48 hours. And what hadn't happened was the healing on the inside, which has taken a lifetime from the rejection. And I had worked in the fashion business as a clerk when I was in college at May Company, which is now Macy's. And I had learned, I had been involved with models and fashion designers and so forth, just as a person on the side. And it so happened that I still had a job with May Company, and one of their models didn't show up one day. This was in one of the outlying stores, and I was the same size as the model. And they asked me if I would wear the clothes that day, which was very bizarre. And I did. And within a year, I was modeling professionally in Hollywood, in Los Angeles, at a very fine store. I can't tell you what this did to my parents. They were completely bewildered because, first of all, they never could quite figure out what happened to my skin. And they never were quite ready to say it was a miracle. They acknowledged that it happened. But blue-collar family, kind of snobbish, poor snobbish. In other words, nice clothes were kind of to look down on. And I was suddenly in this different world. And I looked nice, and I was going from high school when I walked through the cafeteria and people mocked me to walking through a room where I was supposed to be beautiful. I was, in their eyes, beautiful. I had to go. God put me there to teach me to walk through a room because I couldn't even do that. So this was the beginning of a journey. I married. I had children. When I was pregnant with my first son, I had a sudden idea for a book. I'd always written. I'd written poetry, and I wrote I wrote advertising copy. I just was a writer, and had an idea for a book. I hated my job. I hated working. By then, I wasn't modeling anymore. I was doing some other things in fashion. And so I had this idea of a book called Just 5 Days Till Friday, A Survival Guide for Working Women. And it was all about, you know, God put you in your job for a purpose, be a light to the world. It was before feminism had turned us all into career women. And at that point, it was just something to survive. And it, this book, I wrote it. It sold, first person I sent it to. And this was another step, you know. But what I want to say is, you know, even at this early stage of my life, there was a lot of time that went by between the time I learned to praise the Lord or accept from the Lord this sickness. It was years went by before he healed me. And all those years I was working in fashion, years went by before he gave me anything to do that might be of service to him, except just being a Christian in the workplace. So I wrote this book, and little doors opened to other books and ghostwriting here and this and that. And then I met a man who, at that time I was married, my ex-husband's youth pastor was now a very active man in Christian radio. His name was Ed Steele. I don't know if you knew him, Chuck. He was very, very much a friend of Israel as well. And he took an interest in my work and introduced me to a man named Ray Barnett. Ray was an Irishman, Northern Ireland, who was a human rights activist. He was very eccentric. He still is very eccentric. He was a guy that would get an idea watching the news that he should do something about whatever he just saw on the news. And he would do it. And he would get up and go over to behind the Iron Curtain at that time or whatever. And he'd suddenly start being an activist. And introduced to him, he wanted me to write his biography. And I did. And it ended up, I went to Africa because he also had founded the African Children's Choir, which is a ministry of little kids that are orphaned from mostly Uganda who raise funds for their boys and girls in their countries. They're in Kenya and a couple of places. So worked with him, started writing more well-known books, including Raoul Ruiz's book, which was one of which was one of many that I did during those years. But one day Ray called me, and he said he was watching TV, and he saw that there were hostages. I mean, we all knew there were hostages in Lebanon, in Beirut. But he said, I got to do something about this. Will you help me organize an international prayer campaign for the hostages? And I'm like, would somebody please cut off the cable in Ray's house, because this is way too many of these. So I said, sure, whatever, you know. So we made prayer bracelets. We had them made, and we met the families of the hostages. At that time, the best-known hostages were Terry Anderson, who was the Associated Press bureau chief. David Jacobson was from Southern California. He was the administrator for the American University of Beirut's hospital. He's a hospital administrator. Tom Sutherland was, I can't remember, he was a Presbyterian man, and I think he was an educator. And Father Martin Jinko, was a Catholic priest. These four were picked up by Hezbollah, and they were kept together. And they were kept for months and months and months. And so we talked to the families. I got to know the Jacobsons very well because they were from Southern California. Ray didn't want to just make prayer bracelets and events to call attention to this. He decided to go meet with Sheikh Fadlala. And, of course, I was the organizer of that, so somehow I'm making phone calls to Lagos, Nigeria, and the Hezbollah enclave in Toronto and Detroit. These were all people that were related to the spiritual guide of Hezbollah. So we arranged to have some milk sent to West Beirut, and that didn't work out. We found out later that it was during the Iran-Contra that we were working, and we were another distraction to draw attention away from that. But David Jacobson, my boys were wearing his prayer bracelets. My boys were like 7 and 8 or 8 and 9, and they prayed for him every night. And months went by, and I thought, you know, this is going to destroy their faith. Why am I doing this? And I said to them, you know, you don't have to wear those bracelets. We can remember him from time to time. And my son Colin said, Mommy, you have to be patient when you pray for people. And so I said, fine. We'll keep praying. We used to call Colin the little prophet, and he's still a little bit that way, even now. Anyway, very soon thereafter, David Jacobson was in our house explaining to my boys what it was like to be a hostage, how God gave him a dream when he was a hostage of a day that he would be released in November. I don't remember the exact date. He was not a man of prayer. He was not a man of great faith. All of them became much more God-minded and under those circumstances. He was released on the day that he dreamed about. And he believed Ray and I got him out. And I don't think that's true. He still thinks it's true. I think what may have happened was that his name came up during that time, and he might have been released before somebody else. I don't know. I don't believe we got it done. I think that that Ollie North had more to do with it than we did, but that's okay. That was my introduction to Islamic terrorism, was that experience. I didn't know anything about it before that. I thought the New Age movement was the scariest religion on the planet at that point. Over that course of time, I learned about also Idi Amin and his abuse of Christians. Of course, these children were victims of some of the purges he did of Christians and so forth. And then continuing to write books, these subjects came up. I became more and more oriented toward human rights, Christian abuses. And in 1995, I worked with a man named Paul Marshall on a book called Their Blood Cries Out, and it was a book, it was a global survey of Christian persecution. And that's when I really began to look into this and to know about it, and that led to other books, and I kept going with this. So wealthy friends, in the meantime, were taking some of us to Turkey and to Egypt and to different countries to see life and to understand things a little better. And in 2006... there was only one country I ever wanted to see, and that was Israel, and I'd never been here. And everybody had paid my way to Hong Kong and to Russia and all over the place. Never been here. I was in Egypt in 2006, standing on the beach in Nueva Sinai, and I could see Israel. And I thought, you're going to be like Moses, and you're never going to set foot in the land if you don't get yourself there. Just, you know, figure it out. So I did. I went home and I had some mileage on British Airways, and I made a reservation and found an apartment online for 4 months, and I knew I could take my work for a short period of time. Ended up coming here during the second Lebanon War. I didn't know anyone. I had 2 phone numbers and 5 suitcases. And I landed in the middle of a war, one block from the cop's apartment, thankfully. But I never went home. And I didn't come here to stay, but I never left. I go back and forth, of course, I have to. But what happened when I came to this church the first time, and I was very interested in the Jewish people, and I made a lot of friends amongst the Jewish community here, but I always had on the back burner of my mind this Christian persecution thing. And one Sunday, I came here for the first time. There was a man who had just come from Turkey who had met with, at that time, very recently, 3 Christian missionaries had been murdered there. There was a woman who came through who had been in Yemen, whose friend was a doctor who had had her throat slit. And then a couple had been in Gaza, and they had to leave because of the Hamas threat. All in this Church of the Nations, which is exactly what it is. And so I began to think about the fact that although I hadn't come to Israel for that reason, this is something that was coming to me. And I started looking into this story, and then I found something even more surprising. I went to the Herzliya Conference, which is, for those of you who are don't live here, every year annually there's a sort of an international conference on securities and on various issues that affect the country of Israel, but also the rest of the world. I was going from workshop to workshop. I'm a fellow with Hudson Institute, which means that, you know, I am expected to go to these things, and my way is paid, and so I go and listen to various speakers. And in this particular incident, I didn't know where to go. There was nothing I was interested in, so I wandered into a workshop. The workshop was on the 850,000 Jews that were expelled from Muslim countries between 1948 and 1970. I knew nothing about this, and I had always paid a lot of attention to Israel and to the Jewish people. I always had cared about them. And I think now my being an outsider for so many years and with disease and not fitting in, I think I had a heart for what some of these people had been through in their own lives as being outsiders in other countries. But what I learned was that these countries that had expelled the Jews are now persecuting Christians. There's a saying, it's a motto that's spray painted on walls and embroidered on flags, and it says, first comes Saturday, then comes Sunday, or first the Saturday people, then the Sunday people. Meaning, we'll take care of the Jews, and then we'll take care of the... I even have a photograph now of a flag that's in Arabic. It says, Saturday we kill the Jews, Sunday we kill the Christians. So I started working on a book about this, and I didn't really mean to write it about that. I thought I was writing a memoir, but it took on life of its own. At the same time, another book came up, which was about the persecution of Christians globally. And Paul Marshall and I and Nina Shea, who's also with Hudson, we've done 2 books. Now, both of these books are done, thank God. And they're coming out at the end of this year. And I guess I come back to the subject of waiting on the Lord, because he's, you know, the scripture doesn't say he's going to give you a map, or he's not going to give you a schedule of what's going to happen with your life. He doesn't tell you much anything except there's a word behind you. And that means you're moving, and he's just steering you along. And I got to say, it wasn't because I was good. It wasn't because I was a great Christian. But it gave me an opportunity to come to this country to actually experience what people have been through, to sit in their houses, talk to them about what it was like when people next door were being murdered, when people in their family were murdered, when they themselves were victims of terror attacks. I mean, it's what a privilege to sit and hear these things, and then to be able to relate them to the rest of the world. And I just say, in closing, you know, we need to remember that there are people that are crying out to the Lord. He's waiting to be gracious to them. He may wait. Some of them won't live in this life for very much longer, but they'll go to be with him. But he is working in the lives of people all over this planet. The good news is there's a huge amount of revival amongst the Muslim countries. Many, many people are coming to know Christ, and it's very under wraps because it has to be. There are conversions, there are people having visions and dreams of Jesus, there are healings that are drawing them to him. This is the good news. The bad news is that they are public enemy number one if they convert, because that's a capital crime under Islamic Sharia law. So we have here in this place a crossroads between the Christian world and America, the Western world, where it's one kind of struggle against maybe materialism and other temptations, and the rest of the world, which is struggling for its life, as is this country. And, you know, he gives you to do what he gives you to do. He's given me the ability to write, and I'm writing. He led me from disease to healing. He led me one day at a time with huge gaps of waiting. And I'm still waiting for things. But he's faithful. And he is our healer. He is our deliverer. That song is so appropriate. He's our Messiah. He's the Son of God. He's the only begotten Son of God. We bear witness to that in this world, and we're present in the homes of people, even if we don't talk about it all the time. But he is at work in your life and mine. Can't see it every day. Can't hear the voice every day. He doesn't send memos. He just says, this is the way. Walk. And you'll hear a word behind you. So, thank you.